VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're here with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Joining us today are The Times' very own Matt Dickinson and Gary Jacob. Coming up, we'll tell you which Premier League manager wants red cards for diving. But first, mutiny at the Emirates. The front page of the Game today says mutiny. And it all centres on Granit Xhaka, who faces being stripped of the captain's armband after swearing at Arsenal fans who applauded his substitution. The Gunners let a two-goal lead slip to draw 2-2 at home with Crystal Palace as Xhaka was involved in an extraordinary standoff with the Arsenal supporters. His furious reaction came as he was substituted, appearing to swear at the fans after being booed before tearing off his shirt and disappearing down the tunnel. Arsenal had gone ahead very early on in this game. They were 2-0 up inside 9 minutes. Palace then got themselves back into it after a VAR intervention as Luka Milivojevic scored from the spot before Jordan Ayew's header in the second half rescued a point for the visitors. But the result aside, let's discuss Granit Xhaka. And Matt, from what you saw of his behaviour, do you think he's in danger of losing the Arsenal captaincy?
Well, I guess we could say it's a bit of a surprise he got it in the first place. he wouldn't have been my obvious choice. I think his form has not been good enough for that matter. You know, his the Arsenal I've seen this season, Guendouzi's been, you know, outshone him in the midfield in most facets. I think it says something about the Arsenal of now that he has got the captaincy, that there is a sort of lack of alternatives. I always think a good team probably should throw up 3 or 4 captains, and I think that shows a certain weakness at Arsenal. And I think, you know, I've got some sympathy for him in a sense of, you know, when you're getting stick from your own fans, that must be a pretty horrible feeling. And I don't think it was a clever response, but it was clearly a highly emotional one. And I thought it was fascinating just seeing. I thought Match of the Day did a good job of highlighting it last night of the fact that he was hiding from the ball for a long period. And I thought that was fascinating because it showed that here is a guy, you know, his form is not, has been a bit all over the place, but his confidence is gone. Here's a guy who is, you know, say he should be there, you know, acting as the sort of fulcrum, taking the ball off the defence, starting to build stuff. And yeah, he looked like his confidence was so disappeared that he was hiding even from a simple pass. And that's where I have a bit of sympathy for a guy. You know, the feeling of being, you know, in abject form and you know, bereft of confidence, being out there must be a pretty horrible feeling.
How much responsibility, Gary, should we be aiming at Unai Emery then for this situation? I know that Xhaka got the armband after a player vote, but at the end of the day, Emery didn't have to give him the armband. No. He could have questioned it, could have said, is he really the right person for us to be giving the armband to?
Go back to when Emery was appointed. He actually went out of his way to highlight how good Xhaka was and how they had to build a team around him. So I think it's clear from day one he felt he was an important player. The other point is, I don't think Emery's bothered by the armband because he's got 5 captains. I just don't think he thinks of it like the way that we do in England.
Right.
So he's got 5 captains. He's got Xhaka, Bamiyang, Bellerin, Lacazette and Ozil. You think 2 of them, you could have question marks about, and would you have Aubameyang and Lacazette or Bellerin as your captain? Bellerin's been out injured. You haven't got Luiz as your captain. So I just don't think he thinks of it in the same way. Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of thing about Xhaka. But I kind of think the issue really sort of took away from Emery, which is really that the fans now, they were accepting of Emery last season in terms of he had to kind of get rid of the dead wood. He had a difficult squad. But they see now a much better squad. They see a much more talented squad. They see a squad that's got a lot of, in theory, a lot of firepower. And they don't see any progress in terms of playing style, formation, and actually a coherent aspect on the pitch. And they look at it and they think Tottenham are struggling this year, and they think the fourth place is theirs if you're an Arsenal fan. And Emery doesn't seem that he's kind of taken the team forward. So in his defence, he's got new players, and he probably needs time to bed them in. But there hasn't seemed to be any progress. You look at the stats as well; they kind of, if anything, they've kind of gone slightly backwards. And obviously, this is the third game in a week. Sheffield United, they were dismal. They were pretty dismal the other day against Vitória, and they weren't much better a few weeks ago against Watford when they were 2-0 up and then could have lost. I think there's been quite a few, and I don't think there's been one game this season where actually Arsenal have actually played well. And I think that's the thing; it's just a culmination of things, and that's probably in the same with Xhaka as well. I think it's 3 years of Xhaka's mistakes that the fans are probably just a little bit sick of now, and they've looked at him play the passes and the tackles and give away penalties, and I think they've probably just sort of, it's just all coming to a bit of a head now. And I think there's probably going to be some sort of, you feel like there's going to be change over the next 6 months, certainly by the summer.
Xhaka, of course, might not be the best player and perhaps shouldn't be the captain when it comes to on-field matters, but why, Gregor, do we think it is a one-way street that supporters can be upset but players can't?
Who thinks that?
Certain fans have...
Clearly they do, yeah, but they're wrong. I thought it was a disgrace, really. I think, you know, sympathy, you have sympathy for Xhaka but you've got to have sympathy for the entire team. You saw the reaction, even Torreira was like aghast by what he was hearing. And these are guys, they voted for him as their captain, even whether that's right or wrong. And as we've said, there's not many options. There wasn't, you know, I'm not sure there's anyone better, really. But to be booed off by your own fans like that is the most mortifying sort of feeling in the world.
Are you speaking from experience?
I am. Not booed off, but I've been probably twice in 15 years, so not all the time, guys. But I have been booed. I remember actually being booed once. I was played out of position. That's my excuse.
I guess the only equivalent we've got is been going on Twitter and just being...
Yes, well, we get it all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what you feel.
I mean, it's horrible, yeah. Absolutely horrible. And the thing is, it's so self-defeating, you know? Yeah. Arsenal... did you see there was... on Match of the Day again, when he was walking off, and you could see some supporters in the background, and there was one smashing his chair. He was punching his chair. And, like, the anger that you could see and sort of sense in that stadium was completely disproportionate to what... I mean, the team were playing bad, but the one thing is, Xhaka, you know he's going to try. I think the only reason anyone should ever be booed is if they're not given 100%. And I think he does that. He makes some dunderheaded decisions, gives away penalties and free kicks. But it's self-defeating. The supporters are damaging their own team. And this is, you know, Arsenal aren't the only group of fans to do it, but it's absolutely idiotic.
That thing about Lacazette, that's where I sort of raised that. I thought that was interesting about when he was shying from the ball, because that often gets mistaken for not trying, doesn't it? When, you know, when a player is, you know, they're starting to shy away from the action, and then therefore that looks like they're not putting in all the effort, when actually all it is that they're just thinking, you know, I don't trust myself on the ball.
Yeah, and that's understandable, isn't it? And it's interesting what you were mentioning there about the damage to the team, Gregor, because, and as already mentioned, Lucas Torreira looked in tears when he saw what Xhaka was going through. This could have an even more detrimental effect, couldn't it? Because could it not lead to some players thinking, I don't know if I want to go out on that pitch?
Well, it certainly won't help confidence, and there's already not a great relationship between the players and the supporters. And the club, generally. You know, it's actually a kind of thinly veiled secret that footballers don't particularly like their fans at the best of times, because they see them as fickle and able to, you know, if Xhaka bangs one in the top corner in a couple of weeks' time, he'll be lauded and he'll run over to them. And, well, they maybe won't now. But, you know, that is a kind of... the atmosphere in the changing room will not be good after this, and they will not be sort of very supportive of... of the way that was, you know, the atmosphere in that stadium.
Obviously, his reaction is why we're talking about it even more. Would you have ever reacted like that or got close to reacting like that?
It was a silly reaction, but it was a human reaction. It's not, you know, people are calling for him to apologise to the supporters. I think it should be the other way around, if anything. Like, he's playing badly. He's perhaps not a good enough player for Arsenal, but I think anyone would agree that he gives his all when he goes on the pitch, and to boo him is just ridiculous.
And Gary, you said he's what, one of five captains. They've obviously seen something in him to have voted him as a captain.
I mean, he was a Swiss captain at a pretty young age, wasn't he? And so he's obviously got something about it, and everyone was looking at him, and he was highly rated in Germany before he came here. But I just think the fan reaction is just a combination of things over a period of time. It's not just Sunday. It's going back over 3 years. And I think it's just in that one moment where it's just all come out.
Can he come back from this?
That's a good question. You know, yeah, probably yes. But in the long run, is he right to be in front of Arsenal's back four? Probably no, is probably the answer. But, you know, he's going to have to come back because he's not going to move anywhere for 6 months. So they're going to have to find a way to kind of get around it. But I just feel it's all kind of going away. It's all sort of distracting from Emery, when he's the bigger question here, really, that people are looking at. Is he the man to take the club forward? Can Emery get on top of all the multiple of issues? Which, you know, remember, Emery's a head coach. He was not really a manager. So he's there, a coach of things. But these are all wider issues. And has he got it in his repertoire to do that? He was at relatively smaller clubs until PSG. I don't know if he has it, and I think a lot of Arsenal fans will say, thanks very much, you've done a good job, but we want to kind of move forward now.
I remember we were talking in slightly different circumstances, obviously, but about Kepa, weren't we, after, you know, and was there the idea of how can he ever play for the club again? You know, he's going to have to, apologise profusely, and you know, a week later it's dealt with. You know, and I think Gary's right. I think for Xhaka, maybe this is just a sort of a bad week, but for Emery, it's about making sure it's not a bad season, and that's the bigger,
bigger
issue.
Picture, yeah.
Liverpool needed 2 second-half goals to come from behind to beat Tottenham at Anfield and restore their 6-point lead at the top of the table. Harry Kane scored after just 48 seconds to give Spurs a 1-0 lead at half-time, but Jordan Henderson equalised 6 minutes after the break before Mo Salah thumped the winner from the penalty spot to extend Liverpool's unbeaten run at home to 45 league games. So it was a terrific comeback by Liverpool. Gary, was it a performance of champions, would you say?
Yeah, willpower and keeping on going, finding different ways to open the door. I mean, and people said they didn't play well, but they did create a load of chances before half-time. You know, they could have perhaps been 2-3-1 up at half-time. So I think that was, they did show great just carrying on and just banging on the door and banging on the door. And you have to give them the credit for 2 weeks in a running. They could have picked up 0 points and they picked up 4 points in Man United and Tottenham. So, and that's to their credit, because as well as they played last season and parts of this season, that probably is a better performance by them than anything else in relative terms. Mm. So, willpower, to strength to carry on.
Kind of faith in the faith in the system, faith in the way they play, and like a commitment to not changing it, even when as soon as they went a goal behind, they still kind of just swung back into motion, and didn't let it affect them at all. And they're just relentless. It's just the way they wore Tottenham down the further it went. I think Tottenham deserve some credit in terms of, you know, they could have gone 2-0 up even when the ball was flashed across the box just before half-time, I think it was. And then Ali cut it back again. You know, there was 2 chances. And then Son hit the crossbar in the second half. They could have, you know, could have been different. Some question marks about the way Pochettino set the team up in terms of having to ask two of the more creative players, Eriksen and Son, to deal with Liverpool's fullbacks. But Liverpool, like we said, I've said so often in this podcast, have not really clicked into top gear. I think that's probably the closest that they came to finding top gear, I think, this season. and they needed to really to overcome Tottenham, but they deserved to win in the end.
Tottenham also showed that there were ways to get at Liverpool. I thought they were quite long ball at times, Tottenham into Kane and playing off him, and they did show that, obviously Lovren is the weakness, but they did seem to exploit that, and Tottenham did show there are ways to get at this team, which I thought was to their credit.
And in behind Trent Alexander-Arnold on a couple of occasions, who everyone, you know, were gushing about his performance, rightly so. But there were a couple of occasions, particularly Danny Rose as well at the end, could have scored an equaliser. Spacing behind them and stopping crosses is sometimes a weakness still.
Well, the decisive goal came from Salah then, from the spot, after Serge Aurier fouled Sadio Mane. Gary Neville, commenting on the game, called him reckless and that every time he sees him play it, it's either a yellow card, red card, or he gives a goal away. Gary Lineker also tweeted, Aurier, what were you thinking before Roy Keane on TV called the Tottenham fullbacks dumb and dumber? Matt, is Aurier becoming a liability for Tottenham?
I think this, yeah, there was a reputation, shall we say, for erraticism before he came, you know, to Tottenham. I think he was a, as far as I understand, a sort of Levy, you know, I can get him for what seems a decent price for his reputation, signing more than, shall we say, the manager handpicking him. So I think there was a bit of a sort of like, let's take a little bit of a punt on a guy with a lower fee than you might expect from the sort of calibre of club he'd played for, I think. But I think he has proven to be erratic. I didn't think this was some sort of horrendous example of it. Ultimately, he actually starts to make a good clearance under pressure, and to try and finish, you know, that clearance under pressure, he just gets, I think, a little bit unlucky that Mane is just there and alert and puts his foot in. I mean, Mane hasn't nicked the ball off him. He's just managed to get a leg in front of him in time. I can see what Aurier exactly was trying to do. Mm. But I think the trouble is he comes with baggage now. He came with baggage since the day he arrived. And I think, you know, we tend to be, you know, alert to that. So anytime he does make a mistake, it becomes part, you know, seen to be part of his issue. And he's not, you know, he hasn't done a good enough job either of getting rid of that reputation.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear the Defenders Union over there, because I heard you go no. So I mean, is it unfair the way everyone's been talking about him?
Well, I completely agree with Matt. I think, you know, overall, yes, he doesn't inspire confidence, but he made a good tackle, and Mane was very smart and sort of wily to just get his body in between him. It's just one of those moments where as soon as you've done it, you're like, oh my god, what have I done? So yeah, I think it was very harsh, but I think, you know, that's the kind of thing that Roy Keane's making a good living out of just now, just hammering these guys and mixing things up in the Sky Sports studio.
He's good for the soundbite, isn't he?
But probably for Tottenham, it's more symptomatic of the fact that most Tottenham fans will say, why is he playing at right back? Because they sold Trippier without an alternative, and they tried to get Wan-Bissaka but didn't want to pay the fee, and they've ended up with two right backs. And well, Pochettino says he's got 11 defenders. He's got Foyth, who's been fit for 2 weeks and played twice for Argentina, and he says he's going to be the right back, but yet he doesn't pick him. So I think for Tottenham fans, it's kind of the wider thing about why is this guy playing at right back when Foyth is probably not, although he might not be a right back, he's probably just a bit more sensible to play there. And probably the same for Danny, who's having a difficult time all season, really. You know, he walked out of the mix zone the other week at Watford with his head down, sort of had a difficult game. And I think Ben Davis played well against Red Star. There's no perhaps reason why Ben Davis shouldn't have been playing at left back. And I think that's probably the sort of almost a bigger question, and sort of, you know, why Levy didn't trade in the summer to get Aurier out the door, who wanted to go, get Kyle Walker-Peters out the door, and actually just get a proper right back, you know, which is probably all part of the whole thing to do with Pochettino and Levy and what's going to happen. It's like, you know, that's the biggest, or just another pit in it. So, you know, are you going to back me and get me the players I want, or are you not? Are we going to, as Matt says, are we going to look for players who are a deal? But, you know, deals are there for a reason, aren't they? And it's because there's always some catch to them, possibly, you know. And deal, I mean, in Levy's defence, he made a deal a few years ago with Van der Vaart, and he it was a very good deal, and he gets lots of good deals. But there are other deals which you kind of think, Lucas Moura, or you think 25 million on each, you think really maybe you should spend 50 million on a one player in the team, you know.
Well, let's move further up the pitch when it comes to the Tottenham team and talk about Dele Alli, because his performance against Liverpool, perhaps some might say, was again below par. And really, let's discuss what's happened to him. Just 23 years old, let's not forget. But in the Sunday Times this weekend, Graham Souness questioned his focus after suggesting the Tottenham player has stagnated as a footballer. He scored 32 goals in his first two seasons at Spurs, but managed just 7 in 45 games last season. Souness said this of Ali: 2 years ago, I thought Dele Alli was going to be a superstar, a modern-day goal-scoring midfielder from the same mould as Terry McDermott, my partner at Liverpool, or more recently, Frank Lampard at Chelsea. Somebody who could be relied upon to get well into double figures in terms of goals every season for their club. But if the football ladder has 10 rungs on it, Ali's still only on the 4th or 5th. Now, no Premier League midfielder has ever scored more goals than Ali's 43 by the age of 24. So is Souness right? Is he being a bit harsh on Ali, Matt?
I think it's a fair question because, you know, I think we're all sort of wondering, you know, not that he can't reclaim, you know, the momentum he had, but he's definitely lost a lot of it. You know, he wasn't even in the England squad, which is, you know, extraordinary to think about someone who, you know, seemed to be, you know, this was a guy who was just going to sort of cruise to 70, 80 plus caps. I think it's hard to put your finger on one reason. I do think, you know, what player is he? Is the first question I ask. You know, he scored a lot of those goals effectively as a sort of second, some of it as a second striker, as more of a number 10 position. Actually, if you're lining up a 4-3-3, as England certainly do now, Spurs often can do, you know, basically the expectation would be more that he would be a number 8, a sort of box-to-box type player, which is not you know, certainly wasn't how he was playing. He had quite a lot of back-to-goal, you know, when he was having that sort of heyday. He was doing a lot of stuff right around the penalty area, little flicks, you know, diving onto cutbacks. And, you know, if you are playing as one of the wider midfield players in a 4-3-3, it's a different type role. It's very much, you know, driving the game forward, and it's a different requirement. And I think I'd like to think he's capable of it. I think he should be versatile enough. I think he should have the skill set for it. But whether he's struggling to adapt to that different responsibility, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I think that's one issue: tactical, positional. I think, you know, attitude has, I'm not saying that he's, you know, he's sort of, this is one reason he's lost his way, but I know Gareth Southgate, even before he was dropped, this is going back some months, you know, did drop him for matches, basically because he felt he needed a bit of a kick. He felt that he'd sort of gone into,
he'd become a bit complacent.
Yeah, post-Russia, that he'd gone into a bit of a sort of cruise, and that he needed to see more from him. So, I think there may be an issue there, you know. I think so. I say, I don't mean there's one reason, but and also I think, you know, he's not a million miles off sort of rediscovering himself. But I think, you know, as you say, you look at the stats themselves, that's they're pretty startling. But also, I just think, does he have a clear understanding in his head of the player he wants to be, can be, should be? Because I think that has, the requirements of him have changed over the last 2 or 3 years.
His stats have gone, I was looking at the sort of stats earlier, and they certainly have gone down in terms of his goals and assists, but he said at the start of last season he felt he needed to change his game because he was new, and therefore people didn't know how he was going to run into the area and what he could do, and then he had to adjust. And I think perhaps at the start of last season he adjusted his game to perhaps try to pull defenders out of position and to try and create space for other players. So his game, actually, he tried to widen his game to not just be a guy who would get in the box and score goals. But then also, I was also looking at, he's had 5 hamstring injuries since 2017.
Well, this is what I was going to say.
And Pochettino in the summer said, I'm worried about his hamstring. And I think that's one aspect. And also, he looks to be carrying weight. I think that's kind of an unsaid thing. But you look at him and he was quite skinny, wasn't even, maybe because he's younger, but he looks to be, he's either bulked up or he's put on weight, and he doesn't look as fast, have got that kind of drive. Mm-hmm. We remember that goal against Real Madrid a few years ago, wasn't it, at the far post, where he had that thing, and he doesn't look like he's got that sort of... But I think the most embarrassing thing of yesterday was the fact he was trying all these flicks, and they were going to look, and you look and you think, just control and find your man. You know, the extra flicks just seem to be a little bit what you do when you're in the park, and that, I think, is a more symptomatic maybe of other things going on.
But the injuries is a factor that people may not, well, they seem to be forgetting, because as you said, Gary, 5 hamstring injuries. He's only just coming back from a hamstring injury as well, really. That's going to play on his mind, isn't it? This hamstring problem that he's got.
Yeah, hugely disruptive. I think you know, it's understandable. The stats are quite alarming. And he was a player that, you know, so much is expected of and hoped for. But I think also, you know, people are talking about him falling out of love with the game. That was a kind of line in Souness's piece. And, you know, he's got to have some pretty good sources to close to him to be sort of making that sort of claim. And I think, you know, I'm a bit uncomfortable with him going down that route. And even, you know, Roy Keane, as he always does, talking about his modelling and commercial things on the side, as if, you know, concentrating your football. Sound very old-fashioned saying that. Most footballers nowadays have other things, and if he's playing well, nobody says anything about it. So I think, you know, yes, there are issues in terms of how he fits into the system. I agree with that. Injury issues as well definitely played a part, but I think we're getting ahead of ourselves if we're saying that Dele Alli is kind of, his attitude and his head's fallen off and he's, you know, he's fallen out of love with the game.
Mm. I mean, and that's one of the issues there, is that Eric's not playing particularly well. And hasn't played well for 6 months. So who's the one who's going to be putting Alli in?
He's playing in a team as well that are, you know, playing really badly this whole calendar year.
A few issues there which are sort of culminating. But
Well, of other players born in 1996 in the Premier League, Demarai Gray, for example, James Maddison, Dele Alli has played more than twice the amount of Premier League minutes as them. You have the injuries that we've discussed, possibly burnout, as well at such a young age when you're being made to play as often as you are. Could it be a case of too much too young?
I'm not sure too much, but I just think, you know, sometimes, you know, you see some those sort of unique cases where, you know, you get a Rooney or an Owen where they're just, you know, they're prodigious at 17, 18 and just sort of, you know, soar for the next 5 years. But you get other career trajectories where combination of what we just talked about, injuries and maybe, you know, rediscovering a role. I mean, Ross Barkley, you know, when he was 16, 17, everyone said, wow, this kid's going to be the next, you know, Gerrard, Gascoigne, whatever. But look how, you know, up and down and turbulent, you know, his career's been. And you could only say almost only now is he discovering what is, you know, what his next sort of main years as a professional are going to be and what type of role that's going to be and how to make the best of himself. So I think, you know, there are certain players that, yeah, it's up and down for a few reasons. And, you know, I agree with Gregor. I mean, it's this sort of demolishing his attitude to the game seems wider the mark at this point. But, I think it is right to be questioning what we are going to see of Alli, what's his best position, how is he going to rediscover it? But I don't think there's any sort of panic buttons yet.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, the Burnley boss, Sean Dyche, has slammed Chelsea's Callum Hudson-Odoi for diving and calls for players to be sent off in the future. The 18-year-old was shown a yellow card for simulation in the closing stages of Burnley's 4-2 defeat to the Blues at Turf Moor. The referee, Michael Oliver, had initially awarded a penalty but overturned his decision on VAR review. Let's hear from Dyche, who didn't hold back on Hudson-Odoi's antics after the full-time whistle.
We go through a game where someone's blatantly cheated and it doesn't even get a mention now. But I find it amazing now. All I keep hearing is the respect. And you know, it's bizarre. I get questioned about that whenever I talk about it. Like, oh, what's he going on about? And I go, what do you mean what I'm going on about? There's a time in our country and our football, we would never have accepted what is going on now, and no one wants to do anything about it. I find that incredible. Blatant dive tonight, yellow card. What's a yellow card going to do? Give him another chance to dive another week. I just don't see it. I keep hearing this respect. You've got to respect everyone in the stadium now, it seems. I think you've got to respect the chairs. But no one respects the game. I find it peculiar. And then I'll get stick about saying it again. I just find that even more peculiar. I don't really know why. But these are young men, fantastically talented young men, diving all over the place. Why? Why are they doing that? Just get on with the game, because they're the future of it.
So that was Sean Dyche's take then on diving. Has he got a point, Matt?
I can't say I wake up every Saturday morning, even, never mind.
You're more
Tuesday
worried about
morning.
VAR, aren't
well,
you?
Well, exactly. But I mean, you know, it's not the diving epidemic. I'm really not so sure. And the idea of red cards, I just think that's, you know, I understand a manager's frustration if he feels that he's been conned out of something. But in this case, that's one of the joys of VAR, that we can now review these things. Let's put in a good word for VAR quickly while we can, before I get shouted down. And, you know, and I just don't think a straight red card for a dive is going to work. I just think there are too many, you know, real sort of grey areas around it. So, you know, yeah, I think, yeah, Sean Dyche it was a bit of a old school rant, and I think it comes from yeah, exactly. I think it comes from an understandable place, but I don't see an epidemic, and I don't see the need to suddenly sort of wage war on diving.
I suppose the problem, and in particular with this Hudson-Odoi incident, is there will be some people that will have said, yes, it's a foul, but there will be some people that will say it's a dive. So it's still, you know, how can you give a red card to somebody?
Well, actually, exactly. And on that incident, you can see why the referee, you know, gave the decision he originally did. And, you know, it's one of those classics where a foot goes out and a player, you know, it's the old, he anticipates the foul sort of, you know, he thinks I'm about to be tripped and I'm going to take evasive action. So it's not, you know, it's not like he's run into the box and just thought the first, you know, to me, it didn't strike me that he was thinking, I'm going to do whatever it takes here to con the world into a penalty.
Yeah.
UEFA tried to do it years ago with Eduardo when he dived against, I think it was Celtic for Arsenal, and then they banned him and then they got overturned. So,
well, there is retrospective action that the FA can take.
You know, but I mean, Arsenal fought against it and won it on a legal basis. So it's very difficult, as Matt says, to kind of that grey area to prove it, you know. But I mean, as a player yourself, Greg, was it the most annoying thing to see someone diving?
Yeah, but I mean, also the footballers are very clever now, you know. You see, even like Jamie Vardy's when he won that penalty at the last for Leicester's last goal at Southampton. He's the master of throwing his legs across someone, just when you're running at such high speed that you're going to go over, and it looks like a clear penalty. And it is, but it's also in some kind of shape or form a dive.
Yeah.
So footballers are getting very good at it, and I can't understand where Sean Dyche is coming from. But at the same time, a booking is enough, and, you know, referees are much more sort of willing to hand out bookings now. They do it very often. Zaha was booked at the Emirates, and then it was obviously rescinded after it was given as a penalty. So, you know, that's enough of a deterrent, I think, for people to... If you do that once, you're not going to do it again, because if you do, you're off.
I mean, if I was going to wage war on anything, it'd be more like the tactical foul. I mean, I've talked about, you know, if I was going to bring in sin bins... It would
Guendouzi.
Be as much, yeah. I mean, Guendouzi. You know, I mean, to call it a foul is being extremely soft. I mean, as was said at the time, I think, you know, Itoji or someone would have been chuffed with that one. But, you know, that frustrate. If as a regular week to week, what frustrates me more, it's tactical fouling more than the amount of, because the amount of it, and because it kills what is one of the best things in the game, which is the counter-attack. And because, however much they deny it, most managers, you know, they don't just encourage it, they coach it. You know, it's you know, we've seen it from Man City, we've seen it from even, you know, it's part of the game, particularly of teams that push high, you know. So that if I was going to, you know, start my own personal crusade on anything, I'd start there ahead of diving.
Well, you start that one off while Dyche has his little campaign on diving. But just finally on the subject of diving in the penalty box, I know as a fan, sometimes we get frustrated with our own players when you see an opportunity and you think, why didn't they go down? Because if they'd gone down, they might have won a penalty. So there is a responsibility on us as well. We kind of encourage it a little bit. But do managers often say, go down at the slightest touch?
I think that varies, but I think overwhelmingly the answer is yes. Mm. If you have an opportunity to go down in the box, that's the only place that we encourage to do so, yeah. And I think that's happening more and more. I think if there's an opportunity, and like I say, sometimes opportunities are being manufactured to go down. Players leaving or dangling a leg and almost kicking the defender to go over it.
Well, Harry Kane against Arsenal, you know, when you the ball's in front of you and you deliberately slow your run in the hope of a defender banging you in the back, then you can, you know, that's complete. That's as blatant to me as diving, in the sense of contriving a foul out of actually nothing.
Mm. Well, on the pitch, Christian Pulisic marked his first league start since August with a hat-trick as Chelsea came away with that 4-2 win at Turf Moor to make it 7 straight wins in all competitions for Frank Lampard's side. So, how high can they finish under Lampard, Gregor? It's all going very well at the moment.
It certainly is, yeah. I mean, increasingly, just because of the kind of discomfort at Spurs and Arsenal, you feel like it's a battle between Chelsea and Leicester for third and fourth, and which order they finish in, you know? Leicester look in great shape. I'm sure we're going to come on to speak about them. And Chelsea as well. There seems to be goals from everywhere. And until a sort of crazy end to the game at Turf Moor, they're looking a bit more solid defensively as well. So, yeah, I mean, I openly said at the start, I thought they were going to be the team that would probably be struggling to get into even the top six. So I read it wrong. I read it wrong about Tammy Abraham. I'm sure a lot of people did as well. So they are surprising a lot of people just now, as are Leicester. And I just think that Arsenal and Spurs have got too much kind of off-field worries, and Manchester United don't have a good enough team. So I think really they'll be battling out for third and fourth.
Are Chelsea right then to be, or Chelsea fans right to be optimistic, Harry?
No, I mean, I agree with Gregor. I think no one would have seen that with Tammy Abraham, you know. And if they can get the ban overturned and they can do a little bit of trading in January, then they could actually sort of perhaps then just take that step another step forward, really. Perhaps bring a striker in, see what happens with Giroud, maybe another midfield player. But yeah, I think credit Lampard, because no one would have seen how well he would have kind of quickly and quickly have done it, especially early on, because there were a lot of Chelsea fans on his case quite early on thinking, is this right? And we're not sure. But, you know, the way he's brought Mount through, you know, fair play to him.
Mm. Yeah, and I was lucky enough to be in Amsterdam for the Ajax win, and it was, I mean, obviously the win itself made headlines rightly, but I tell you what most impressed me was just the attitude of the team, of you know, even when they were under pressure. Someone like Jorginho, who, you know, under Sarri did look, you know, could look ponderous and a bit actually one-dimensional, but suddenly he was there doing all the dirty jobs, you know, suddenly looking a much more versatile, much more urgent player. And I think that's just a question of the manager instilling a different attitude in him, different sort of set of demands in him, and him rising to that challenge. So I think, you know, Frank, as Gary says, is at the moment, I think what's most impressive is he seems to have a coherence about it. You can see what he's trying to do. You can see what he's trying to build. I think there will be some bumps in the road because it's a young team. But, you know, more than certainly, say, somewhere like Arsenal, you see a coherence to it.
But they look like they're playing for him, don't they? Which actually, sort of, recent Chelsea managers have suddenly sort of turned quite quickly. But as Matt says, it's a young team, so can Tammy Abraham play 40-odd games a season in his first season at Chelsea, regularly? That's quite a lot.
You assume Giroud might be looking to jump ship in January.
You've got Batshuayi there, who Palace are keen on. He's got 18 months left. So there's kind of a few things in the background. And I think the other thing in his credit is that in the summer people said, you know, why are you selling Luiz? We could do with defenders. And he's made that decision. And actually, you know, it's worked out okay for him so far. He's taken those decisions. And so everything I think he's done, he's kind of profited from so far. So
all looking good for Frank Lampard and Chelsea then. Now, on his travels around the country this weekend, Gregor's been to Southend United to see how Sol Campbell's been settling into life in League One. perhaps expected that the league leaders Ipswich were too good for them as they ran out 3-1 winners at Roots Hall on Saturday. But, Gregor, were there any signs of encouragement for the South End fans?
Well, yeah, at least they didn't concede 7 goals as they did against Doncaster on Tuesday night when Saul Campbell was watching on from the stands. 3-1 defeat. Ipswich, obviously, top of the league. It was a very challenging start for them, but I was just quite kind of surprised to see how little expectation there is among the support for him to turn it around already, you know?
Really?
Yeah, I mean...
What, they're resigned to going down?
I think
down?
So, yeah. I think they feel it's the worst, you know, the worst circumstance the club's been in 30 years was what the local Southend Echo reporter told me. And there was one of the most kind of scathing editorials in a fanzine I've ever read about the team and the group of players and how they're basically a disgrace to the badge. So,
wow.
I think a lot of people trace it back to a changeover in their CEO, Steve Cavanagh, left from Millwall 3 years ago, was never replaced, and the chairman, Ron Martin, who's been there for 2 decades, kind of took all everything upon himself, and their dealings in the transfer market have been a disaster. So they're already 8 points from safety, 2 points worse off, or they should be, than Bolton Wanderers, who started, they played their first handful of games with a youth team. So this is a bad side he has. So, I mean, at least, like I say, there's not much expectation on his shoulders, but the same was true of when he went to Macclesfield last November. They were 7 points adrift in League Two at the time. And against kind of all expectations, he kept them up on the last day of the season. So I think the fans are pleased to have him there simply because he showed last season that he was very capable in similar circumstances. Mm. But I think it's a more difficult job. I think it's not... So Macclesfield were a team who had one of the lowest budgets in League Two, but they had a bit of spirit because they won the National League the season before. They were quite a together group. Whereas Southend, the owner, Ron Martin, says they have a top six budget. It's just been spent awfully. And there's a lot of players who kind of look like they don't want to be there. So he's got a tough job on his hands.
Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Matt Dickinson and Gary Jacob.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. And we'll be back on Thursday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.